This is Ozarks at Large. A year and one day ago on our show, we invited Tris Starks, professor of history at the University of Arkansas, onto our show to give us a preview of an honors college session she was going to lead about the history of pandemics. Now, 366 days later, we've invited her back to talk about another forum she'll lead for the Honors College, part of a two-week series of sessions about vaccines. She'll lead a forum about the history of vaccines. We asked her what the past 12 months have been like for her, a student of medical history, watching history unfold every single day.
Yes, I have been surprised. As a Russianist, as a historian of the worst, all I can think of is the Mel Brooks song from the 12 Chairs. Hope for the best, expect the worst. And that has been playing through my mind. If there is one song of the pandemic for me, it has been that it is hope for the best, expect the worst. And yet I have been astonished at how bad things have gotten and the levels of where that worst can be. In some ways, definitely recalibrated the way that I teach, the way that I think about the history of disease, the way I think about the possibilities of modern medicine. And you and I have talked before, I'm not necessarily an unjaundiced view of modern medicine. I'm always very skeptical of the heroics and the miraculous and the pictures that lack a shade of gray. And yet my picture of the past has grown a bit darker as we have lived through a year of shadow.
Well put. And as you and I talk, of course, the planet is at one of its worst stages for infections. We're seeing it rage through India where there's not enough oxygen and not enough space to take care of the sick. We are anything but out of this as a global citizenry.
Yes. And yet, you know, in the back of your mind, as we're finishing the semester here at the university and looking towards the fall semester and how our class is going to be, we're planning for an in-person in the fall. We're, you know, we are hopeful. We are constantly hoping for the best.
And
moving forward with that idea. And that is the other thing that even as I've been astonished at how badly it has gone in many cases, I am also constantly amazed at the speed and strength of the response from scientists and researchers. And that's what's great about this class. If our last class was a class as we were coming into the worst of it, just starting into lockdowns, just starting into some of the worst waves here in the United States, in New York and elsewhere. Now we're looking at it from that hopeful side, right? We're looking at it from the side of vaccine. We're looking at it from this, again, just amazing outpouring and quick identification of the virus, identification of therapeutics, identifications of methods of containing spread, and then identification of vaccines. And it's such a relatively young field in the history of medicine to see it moving this quickly and to see it moving into these new directions of research and RNA vaccines, which are exceedingly new, and to have them be so successful so quickly is hopeful. So it tamps down the Russianist within me.
That's great. Yeah, the title of the session that you're going to be leading the discussion on is History of Vaccines, Politics of the Present. Let's look at the history of vaccines, because vaccines, compared to medicine as a whole, have a relatively brief history, right?
Right. I mean, I'm going to take my time in the course to talk about one particular set of questions, the question of smallpox and the development of the smallpox vaccine with Edward Jenner. And you know, he publishes his findings or in the 1790s. It's not that long ago in historian speak. That's not that far. And he's considered the father of vaccinology. He's considered the father of the field. And we'll talk about smallpox and his development of the vaccine and how, you know, how he's really kind of a tinkerer. He's a naturalist. He's not really, this isn't his only field of inquiry.
Given, you know, smallpox and polio and the time it took and the battles that had to be done in the lab to get these successful vaccines, this is unprecedented what we have seen in the speed that Pfizer and Moderna and J&J were developed.
And the speed and the relative success. I mean, if we look at how each one of them has been really quite effective and surprisingly effective on variants, most of them too. It's just awe-inspiring. Again, a little hopeful. I'm just shocked at the end of this to be a little hopeful.
These vaccines kind of, you know, they had a public-private sort of partnership because of the enormity of the pandemic. I'm wondering what you know about Jenner in the late 18th century. Was he on his own? Did he have help? Did he have patrons?
He paid to self-publish.
Wow.
He paid to publish the thing. But he does become a cause celeb. Once Jennerization, it becomes the way that Europe wants to be introduced and he to inoculation. And he is celebrated by the state. He's celebrated across Europe. His ideas become very, very pronounced and quite lauded, as does he. But yeah, at first he's kind of celebrated. He's kind of on his own. And then we think about the same with Salk, that, you know, he is funded through March of Dimes, through public public donations that are set off by Roosevelt and set off by, you know, kind of a higher presence. But it's largely a public funded effort. And that's actually, if people talk about that actually getting in the way of greater vaccine development, that as people have looked more towards private efforts or towards, you know, public charitable organizations to develop vaccines rather than government funding, it's led to kind of drying up of government funds. It's led to groups not being interested in the development because vaccines aren't big money. And so it actually, that kind of move towards more private funding, more charitable funding has been problematic in development of more vaccines.
In the 18th century, how big a problem was smallpox?
Smallpox was a massive problem. 3 in 10 people, when you get smallpox, 3 in 10 people in the wild, viral mm-hmm. smallpox, 3 in 10 will die. That's in a population that has had some exposure. They estimate that in some populations, virgin populations that hadn't had previous exposure, in the Americas, for example, when explorers come over and we have a massive outbreak in the 16th century, they estimate some areas it might have been 50 to 70% mortality rate from smallpox. And even people that don't die, it's horribly painful. These pustules form on the body. They form craters in the skin that can be longstanding, that can be with you for life. You lose your eyelashes, you lose your eyebrows, all sorts of problems that come. You can be disfigured. You can be blinded by smallpox. In addition to, you know, just death, there are all of these other outgrowths. And it's estimated that it killed about 400,000 people a year in Europe, responsible for about a third of the cases of blindness. It just is a massive killer. So yeah, it's a big problem. And so people are looking for ways to survive it. But we're also going to talk about King Carlos IV of Spain and inoculation in the Americas. So King Carlos the Fourth, he had a horrendous time with smallpox. His family has a lot of problem. His brother is lost to smallpox, his sister-in-law, his three-year-old daughter. And so he variolates his entire family and in 1798 declares the entire civilian population of Spain should be variolated. And then once Jenner comes up with his ideas and he finds out about that, he pushes the idea that they need to do this for the entire New World, all of the Spanish colonial areas of the New World. However, laudable, right? Great, great idea. To do that, they need to get the lymph. They have to get a viable amount of cowpox to the New World. To do that, they use a chain of 22 orphans, starting off in Spain. And after those two get to the point where they can be turned into infectious agents for the next two, to the next two over a series of months so that they can bring that infectious matter to the New World where they will inoculate over 500,000 people. I mean, it's massive, massive. But they do it by basically using children as mules for the virus.
So, okay, one last question connecting these vaccines that we've got now to those. I've been amazed at how a shot in 2021 doesn't hurt. I barely, you know, I look away. I don't know what's happening. It's over in a matter of seconds. What was it like to get a shot? Do we know what it was like to get a shot in to get immunized against smallpox?
When it comes to Jenner's form, what they would do is they would use a lancet, which is basically an abrasive tool, and cut into the skin and then smear pustule matter over that cut in the skin. And that's one of the things that leads to certain amounts of vaccine hesitancy in the 19th century is because people start to see it, start to confer on it that it's the mark of the beast. Again, you have this kind of worry about mixing of cows with humans. And then also you have this scarring that would last for the rest of your life. I mean, of course, I still have my inoculation scar from when I was inoculated years back. I know kids don't get that anymore, darn it. but, you know, that mark was one that was seen as a reason that people refused to get it. And then there's also just one of the reasons for vaccine hesitancy in the 19th century in England will be that inoculation takes place in poorhouses and in other points that are already seen as areas not where upstanding people would go. And then they would just take and abrade the arms of multiple people and then just move the lymph from arm to arm. And so there's this worry of contagion with the people around you too. Mm. So not just that you're getting lymph from cows, but actually by the 19th century, we've moved into a different kind of lymph. It's no longer cowpox lymph. Technical issues aside, the movement of the lymph from arm to arm, people were worried it was going to carry syphilis. People were worried it had a moral contagion to it so that, you know, you might end up with the problems of the people next to you, because again, they're not quite sure of the difference between inheritance and disease and where are these things mixing out in the 19th century. So they're worried that things might be passed on with that movement of the lymph. And so the techniques of the time also added to these problems. But, you know, these techniques are such interesting things. If you think back to, you know, back to those orphan chains and how do we solve that? Same thing that we were talking about in whatever fall of this year, last year, where it's like, oh, well, the Moderna has to be stored at such and such degree.
Right.
How do we do that? How do we change that? And they're dealing with it in Spain in the early 19th century. How do we transfer this to the New World? Interesting. How do we keep this in a viable state? So we have these same questions, just different answers and different vulnerabilities shown at each point, right?
Yeah. Well,
because I mean, then it was the kids that were put on the chopping block, so to speak, and with the Moderna and the Pfizer, it was a question of, well, how do we get this beyond urban areas where they have the technology? And so it's always a question of how are the vulnerable either going to be harmed by this process or helped, and how can we try and balance that to be most effective? Because we're finding out in a way that they didn't know then, but we're finding out even more how interconnected our world is, how much if we don't help everyone out, those variants are going to become a problem for everyone, and that it has to be a group solution.
Trish Starks is a professor of history at the University of Arkansas. She'll lead one of the sessions of UA Honors College devoted to vaccines. The sessions begin Monday. That's May 10th. And those sessions will be open to members of the community and also recorded for later viewing as well. You can learn more by following a link that we've provided at OzarksAtLarge.com.